not so much at societies as we're looking at individuals. So how does this work in the case of an individual in terms of, in particular, this triptych of values, vision, design? You're going to hear me harp on that for the rest of the semester, that values are a very important mechanism for solving indeterminate problems. And that idea of bringing your values to help create a vision and then designing a solution based on those values and that vision, this is a key creative problem-solving technique. So we're going to be looking at these two individuals today and Thursday. Today, mostly Alexander Hamilton. And we're interested in what is the role of individual values in creative problem solving. How does one individual human being, in their value system, use those values as a mechanism for creative problem solving? Well, the definition of values that we looked at a long time ago. Sorry, can we go back to the definition of values? So the definition of values are, number one, it's a standard by which you make judgments. So it acknowledges that, if a problem is indeterminate, it means that you can't solve it on the basis of just facts. You have to use judgment. And the standards you use to make that judgment are values. Then the second part of that definition is values are ideals that are not immediately susceptible to rigorous proof. So this is not something that you can say, this is a fact, I know this. A lot of times we confuse values with facts, so especially like in political discussions these days, people state it as if it were fact. This is what has to be done. This is a fact. No, it's not a fact. It's a value you're bringing to it. There is no way you can use rigorous proof to completely demonstrate that as a fact. But it is perfectly legitimate to have these ideals that are not immediately susceptible to rigorous proof, and that those are the basis for making judgment. So that's what we're talking about today. So one key thing to think about today is, how do we acquire values? Where do they come from? And the Twitter card question today is going to ask you to identify some values, but I want you to really think about, how do I have the values I have? And part of this case study is looking at this interesting guy, Alexander Hamilton, and trying to figure out, how the hell did he have the values he had? Where did they come from? How do we acquire values? Then another question is, how do values help you decide what problems you want to solve and how to approach them? It can be a very key thing in figuring out what problems you want to solve. We talked a little bit about that decision about what problems you want to solve. In a way, that's what your major is. Why did I decide to go into elementary education? And, if you think about it, it may well be that you just think it's really important that little kids learn how to learn, and that you see that is so key in their success and their happiness, and because you're a caring person that really identifies with little kids, that's values you bring to the situation. And you make a decision about what problems you want to solve, what major you want to have, because you have those values in the back of your head. So I think it's good to be explicit about how those values help you decide what problems you want to solve. So we're going to be looking at these two people. And there are people who you know these names, and in some ways I'm a little hesitant to use them as an example, because I know that people think, Thomas Jefferson, I know these people that I read about them. We are not looking at them as historical figures. I don't freaking care about all the historical data. What we're looking at is, these are two individual human beings who grew up at the same time, but grew up in completely different contexts, ended up having completely different values. And then when they came to the opportunity to solve some critical problems about what our country was going to be, they brought completely different agendas to the table. And we want to understand how they were so fundamental in shaping the country we have. They had extremely creative ideas about what a new nation could be back in the 18th century. But they didn't just come with those out of the blue sky. They had values and they had experiences they brought to it. And actually, you can see by these boxing gloves, they did not get along with each other. They were rivals. They were, in some ways, enemies. And it was because they had very different values. It wasn't because they were mean guys who just were pissed off. It was because they fundamentally had a different vision of what America should be, and they were fighting about that. So in the case of Thomas Jefferson, he liked rural life, and agriculture, and the value of the individual. That's what he was all about. He came from Virginia. He grew up in a wealthy plantation family. He thought that was the future of America, is wealthy plantation families and agriculture, and the individual sitting on their mountaintop in their beautiful home, thinking great thoughts, and that was his vision of the best of what America could be. Alexander Hamilton, on the other hand, said, I like cities. The future is not about this rural countryside. It's about cities. It's about commerce. It's about trade. It's about centralized government. Government needs to be strong. They need to be able to represent the will of all the people, not a few elite people. And so he had a completely different vision. And that's where the conflict came between these two people. Now, one thing that's very interesting is that they actually had a lot in common. Both of them were redheaded. Both of them were extremely handsome, considered extremely handsome in their era. Both of them were ladies' men. They really attracted the ladies. Both of them had scandals over romantic liaisons that were not exactly right. Both of them lost their father at an early age. Both of them then had a kind of surrogate father figure in George Washington, who was kind of a mentor and father figure to both of them. So in a kind of personal sense, they had a lot in common, but then they also just had completely different values. So we're going to be interested today in this story of Alexander Hamilton. Honestly, if I were any good at singing, I could just sing you the musical Hamilton. And that would be cool. I wish I could do that. And it would be extremely entertaining. But it's exactly the same material. What I'm going to tell you in narrative form is exactly the content of the musical. But I will tell you that if you go to see the musical, anybody seen Hamilton? Oh, several of you. So if you go to see the musical, it's actually helpful to know what I'm going to tell you today, because there's a lot of the backstory that's not clear in the musical. And if you know it, you think, ah, I get it, I understand that. But in the musical, it's a little bit shorthand. So take good notes today, and if you ever go see the musical, right before the musical, review your notes, and it'll help you understand the nuances of the story that's depicted in the musical. It's exactly the same story we're talking about today. Okay, so little Alexander Hamilton is born in Nevis in the West Indies in either 1755 or 1757. And we don't know exactly, because we think he probably lied about his age a little bit later because he was embarrassed. And I'll tell you that bit later. But we don't really know exactly when he was born. So he had a very interesting family. His mother was a woman named Rachel Fawcett, and her family had been a fairly wealthy plantation-owning family in the West Indies, and her father was quite successful. and had land and, you know, was fairly wealthy. However, her father died when she was like 12 years old. So her mother was completely incapable of taking over the family business. And so they were floundering because there was nobody to run the business. They had this plantation, but no one to run it. It's just her mom and this 12-year-old girl. And so her mom gets the idea of what I need is to marry Rachel off to some guy who will run the plantation. So she's shopping around for a husband for this 12-year-old girl. And she finds this Danish guy named Johan Ladin. And he was very dapper, very well dressed, and a lot older than Rachel. He was like in his, like he's 35, and she's 12 years old. And he sees this opportunity. It turns out she thinks he's a pretty wealthy guy because he's pretty flashy. But in fact, he didn't have any money. It was all fake. And he fooled her into thinking that he was this very sophisticated, very capable guy. So Rachel gets a little bit older, and I think like they married when she was 14, and immediately have a kid. And so they're just married for 5 years. But in that 5 years, he runs through a lot of the money. He mismanages the plantation. He's very cruel to Rachel. That was a big, big mistake, this marriage. So Rachel runs away. So she's 19 years old. And she actually leaves the island of St. Croix, where they were living, and goes to St. Kitts, another island in the Caribbean. And she's, like, devastated. Young woman, she leaves her kid, but she can't take him with her. She leaves her kid, and she runs home. And she's penniless. She doesn't have any money. But she ends up on St. Kitts. She's smart, and she's capable. She starts a little shop on St. Kitts, and she's making a living for herself. He's trying to get her back, and there's all kinds of legal wrangling going on. But anyway, she's like this 19-year-old woman, a little shopkeeper in St. Kitts. And then she meets this guy named James Hamilton. James Hamilton is Scottish. His family was a very wealthy family in Scotland. But he's the fourth son of this Scottish laird, like a lord. In Scottish law, the first son gets all the inheritance, and anybody else gets just a little pittance that they can go and try to make their fortune with. So he gets his little pittance, and he goes to the Caribbean to try to make his fortune. And turns out he sucks at making a fortune, and so he squanders his money, and so he's in St. Kitts, and he's kind of penniless, but from a really good family, and he and Rachel hook up, and that's the mom and the dad for actually Alexander Hamilton, and he had an older brother 2 years older than he was too, so they're living together in St. Kitts, and they're making it primarily on Rachel's income, and James is kind of a screw up. But both of them came from very good families and from very wealthy and, you know, all that, well-educated families, but both of them are totally down in their luck. And they get together and they have these two kids. So up top there is his birthplace in Nevis. He was illegitimate because Rachel was still married to Johan Ladin. He wouldn't divorce her, and so she and James never got married. So that was something he was embarrassed about for his entire life. So you've got to remember that this place was crazy wild. The Caribbean was just very raucous, and there was no governance structure particularly. So there were, when people had a dispute, they just had a duel and killed one of them. That took care of the dispute. There were lots and lots of illicit relationships. So this thing between Rachel and James, that wasn't unusual. They weren't married. They had all kinds of liaisons. A lot of times it was with slaves. This was very much a slave culture. There were way more slaves than there were slave owners, so that it was like 70% of the population were slaves. The slaves were treated really, really badly. 3 out of 5 slaves would die in the first 5 years they were in Philadelphia. 3 out of 5 died within 5 years of coming to Philadelphia. There were big sugarcane plantations. It was super hot. They were worked really hard. And then there was this craziness around money and income. So it was a wild and deviant kind of place. So in 1766, Hamilton's father deserts the family. He's 11 years old. And then in 1768, 2 years later, his mother dies. And she died of a disease. There were epidemics that would hit in the Caribbean, very poor health care, and periodically there would be these epidemics. And in one of those epidemics, she gets super sick. Alexander Hamilton also gets sick, and he almost dies, but he recovers, but his mom dies. So he's like 12, 13 years old, and now he has neither parent. The father's deserted, the mother has died. So after the death of the mother and the desertion of the father, Alexander and his brother went to live with a cousin named Peter Layton. That was a cousin through his mother's family. And Peter Layton was a screw-up too. He did many botched business dealings. Had had money, but had squandered a lot of money. He was living with a slave mistress at the time. And then within a year of them coming to live with Peter Layton, he commits suicide. So now we have these two kids, and they're penniless, and they're orphaned, and they have no relatives to go with. And Alexander Hamilton's 14 years old. So at that point, his older brother gets apprenticed out to be a carpenter, and Alexander Hamilton is kind of taken under the wing by a guy named Thomas Stevens. Thomas Stevens was, he had a son, Alexander Hamilton's age, and his son and Alexander had kind of been buddies. And in fact, there was an uncanny resemblance between these two kids. And there were some people who thought that secretly, Thomas Stevens was the father of Alexander Hamilton, and not James Hamilton. But that's pure rumor. There's no substantiation of that. But anyway, Thomas Stevens kind of takes a little interest in Alexander Hamilton, and he finds him a pretty good apprenticeship. So he's living in the Stevens household, but he's got an apprenticeship with a merchant. And that was a really, really good break for Alexander Hamilton. So he's learning a trade. He's learning to be a merchant. And that really is what made the Caribbean work, was it was trade. It was a place where people would, they had the sugarcane plantations, and the sugarcane was made into rum. And rum was used as the primary export product, and then they brought in everything else they needed by trading the rum for other things. So he learns how to write. Prior to that time, he had no formal education, because in the Caribbean, about the only schools were Anglican schools, so there were church schools, and the Anglican schools would not allow an illegitimate kid to be in the school. So because he was illegitimate, he was disqualified from going to school. So he had no formal education. He's 14 years old. But he learns how to write because he's an apprentice to this merchant. He learns accounting. He learns how to keep the books and do numbers. He learns about money management. You know, that's what commerce and trade is all about, how much money is coming in, how much money is going out, how to balance the books, how to make a profit. He learns that. He learns about trading. He learns about pricing, because everything is bargaining. So it's not like you walk in their shop and everything's got a price on it. Yeah, everything's negotiated. So his job was trying to make sure the pricing would work. And he also learned about currency exchange, because in the Caribbean they didn't have any uniform currency. So you might be using British pounds, you might be using French francs, you might be using Spanish doubloons. They were using all kinds of different currencies. And the exchange rates would change radically, and you had to kind of keep up with the exchange rates. Of course, communication back and forth with Europe was very, very spotty. So currency exchange was a really, really big problem. So there are even things like what his job was sometimes was to determine the price of a slave, so that he would have to figure out, you know, how healthy is this slave and what should the appropriate price be, because his merchant did deal in slaves as well. So that he was so good at these things that this merchant who he worked for had to go to what was labeled to be the United States, but go to America on a business trip. And he left Alexander Hamilton, this 14-year-old kid, in charge of the shop. He felt he was the most responsible and the most sort of intelligent and capable person there. And even though he was super young, he was given that kind of responsibility. So he also gained really intimate knowledge of traders, and these were unscrupulous people. So he had to figure out, is somebody screwing me? You know, he had to get judgment about that. He learned all about smuggling, because people were constantly trying to get around taxation by smuggling things in and out. He learned all about slavery intimately, in that he was, you know, dealing in slaves, and he was seeing the slaves in this horrible situation of 60% of them dying within the first 5 years. He saw these cruel treatments of slaves, so he knew all about that. He also saw this anarchy and disorder, because there was no, you know, uniform currency, there were no legal systems, there were no courts, people were solving their disputes by duels. It was just complete anarchy and disorder. He also saw the tyranny of wealthy planters. So there was this minority of plantation owners, and they were running the whole show in these islands. And they were extremely cruel and greedy, and had incredibly unscrupulous behavior. So he had no respect for these planters. He also saw the cash credit crunch. People were always borrowing money to plant their crops of sugarcane, and then a hurricane comes in and destroys their crops. But they've got this debt. So everybody was often getting screwed by this credit that was being extended. And the people who were extending the credit were sometimes charging terrible high interest rates. And so the whole cash credit crunch was a mess there. We saw the value of a uniform currency if we just didn't have to constantly be thinking back and forth between francs and doubloons and pounds. And then at least we could make this trade more predictable and more stable. And then he also saw the problems of a singular agricultural economy, because they were all dependent on the sugarcane crops. And if your grain crop was good, the economy was fine. If there was a hurricane or there was some of the disturbance of the sugarcane crop, then the entire island was screwed. Everything just came to a standstill. And that dependence on the singular agricultural economy, he could see the problems of that. Okay. So, when he's about 17 years old, there is a horrible hurricane that hits the Caribbean. And, I mean, we know from these days, in the Caribbean, you're going to have a hurricane periodically. And this was a particularly devastating storm, and basically everything was ruined on his island. And so he had been writing a lot. He loved reading and writing. And so he wrote a long letter to his father. Now, he's out of touch with his father. He doesn't really know exactly where his father is. But he has an address where he can send a letter to. He's not getting correspondence back from his father. But he writes a long letter describing the hurricane and what happened in the hurricane to his father. It's a really sweet story, this poor kid who wants a parent so bad and is just longing for some contact with his father that has nothing to do with him. But he writes this really, really long description of what happened in the hurricane and the aftermath. And he's very critical in this letter of how this culture is completely unprepared for that kind of devastation. That we're just not planning. It's inevitable it's going to happen, and we have not planned for it. In some ways, bad on us because we're not equipped to deal with a natural disaster like that. So before he sends the letter off, he runs it by this guy, Hugh Knox. Hugh Knox is a pastor, a minister at one of the churches here. And he had taken an interest in Alexander Hamilton. So he just shows him the letter. I'm sending this to my dad. You know, if you've got anything I'll to add or give me suggestions. So Hugh Knox reads the letter and he's just blown away. It's such a poignant and beautiful description of the storm and of the maladies that this culture has in dealing with something like this. So Hugh Knox says, I think you ought to publish this in the newspaper. Now, Alexander Hamilton had written some poems and had them published in the newspaper. So it wasn't like that was completely out of the blue. But Hamilton thought, no, this isn't good enough. And also because it was a little critical, that people might get upset with him saying that. And so he told Hugh Knox, no, I don't want to publish the newspaper. But Hugh Knox is really adamant about this. And he comes back and says, well, what if we publish it under a pseudonym? So it's not your name. But I think people need to read this. So it does get published in the newspaper under a pseudonym. And the leaders on the island get very, very interested in that letter. It really makes an impression on people. And so Hugh Knox tells a few of them that this was written by the 17-year-old kid, Alexander Hamilton. And they're blown away by that. It was so insightful and so well written. And so there's a group of them, Hugh Knox and these other business people, who said, you know, this kid needs an education. He needs to be able to have an opportunity to go to college and to get some education. So they actually took up a little collection among them and decided to send him to America to get an education. There were no colleges or higher education in the Caribbean. So this is a remarkable thing of these guys helping him out and giving him a break and sending him to America. And there he goes to Elizabethtown College. Sorry, that was that building you see up there. Just stay here. That's fine. Let's go back. But Elizabethtown College was a college in New Jersey, and it was kind of a feeder school for Princeton. Hugh Knox had gone to Princeton, so he thought, what I want is for Alexander Hamilton to Princeton. So we'll send him to Elizabethtown Academy. He'll get a year of preparation, and then he'll be able to get into Princeton. So that was the plan. He goes to Elizabethtown Academy, and he busts his ass. He does everything he possibly can, but he is so far behind. He has had no formal education. He's 17 years old. He's competing with people who are 3 or 4 years younger than he is, and they've had an education, and they know all these things, and he doesn't. And he's just scrambling to try to catch up. And he busts his ass for a year, and then he takes the admission test for Princeton, and he doesn't get into Princeton. He fails. And that was devastating to him, because these people had sponsored him, and the idea was that he was going to get into Princeton. He didn't get into Princeton, but he did get into King's College, which is was the predecessor for Columbia in New York. So he takes that as second best and decides that he's going to go on to King's College. And that's okay with his sponsors. They're disappointed he didn't get into Princeton, which was a better school, but he did get into King's College. So then he moves to New York, and right there in that photograph, you can see New York at the time was in turmoil because it was the beginning of the Revolutionary War. So there were little militias being formed, and there were people who were getting behind this notion of fighting the British and breaking off and becoming an independent country. So this is 1776. So the Declaration of Independence is being written by Thomas Jefferson down in Philadelphia. In New York, they're forming these little militia groups to be the Continental Army. And he first starts pamphleteering and volunteering, and then he joins one of these militias and decides that he's going to drop out of college and he's going to join the Continental Army and be a part of this movement for the independence of the United States. So he does that and joins the army. They do the Declaration of Independence. Up in Boston is the first big fight. That was Paul Revere and won it by land, won it by sea, and you know, Concord and Lexington and all of that. And they whip the British ass in Boston, and the British fleet had to flee Boston with their tails beat. But then the Brits send more reinforcements over from England, and the ships all unite, and then they sail to New York Harbor. And that's where the next big fight happens after Boston, is in New York. And now George Washington is the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, and he's assembling this army in New York. And the British fleet comes into New York Harbor, right here, right up there. Let me see if I can get the pointer to work, since it doesn't work with fancy slides. Maybe it will work to point. So they come into the harbor there. They land in Brooklyn over here. There's Manhattan right there. George Washington's army with Alexander Hamilton was in New York. They cross over and they absolutely just demolish the Continental Army and just completely overpower them because they're well-trained British troops and the Continental Army is a scrappy little bunch of people who don't know what they're doing. And so Washington starts fleeing from the British troops and he flees all the way up here and he's trying to get across the Hudson. He finds a crossing up here, crosses across the Hudson, and then comes back down like this through New Jersey. And all the time the British are on his tail. And what they're heading for is down here to Philadelphia, really Trenton, which is across the river from Philadelphia in New Jersey. And that was Washington crossing to Delaware. The Delaware River runs between Trenton and Philadelphia. And then that's where Valley Forge is. And they're trying to get there and get away from the Brits so they can hole up for the winter, because they're not going to fight in the winter time. And if they can just get away from the Brits and find a stable place to be for the winter, that's what Washington's trying to do. So this whole time when they're going up here, the Brits are right on their tail the whole time. And Alexander Hamilton, who's not an officer or anything, he's a little scrappy nobody, but he has this idea of what if a little group of us pull away from the rest of the army, and we go around behind the Brits, and we start attacking them from the back. And that's going to slow them down. Now they're going to have to worry about us as well as worry about chasing the bulk of the army. So he got authorized to do that, and he led a little group of people who just went behind the Brits and just pestered them and slowed them down. And that helped Washington make it to Valley Forge and be able to spend the winter there. And then there was that famous battle at Christmas where they actually went across the Delaware and attacked the Brits, and that was the first victory Washington had in the Revolution. But obviously, this scrappy little dude has made a mark, and Washington notices what he's doing there. And so Washington, when they're encamped in Valley Forge, he kind of brings Alexander Hamilton into his tent and into his inner circle, and he makes him his aide-de-camp. The aide-de-camp was like the right-hand person of now the general of the Continental Army. So that's a super responsible position, but Alexander hated it. He did not want to be the guy in the general's office. He wanted to be the guy out there with the troops and fighting the battles. But Washington thought he was too valuable to do that, and so he kept him in the inner circle of the administration of the army. Now, there were three things that Hamilton was good at that Washington was not good at and that he depended on Hamilton for. Number one, Hamilton was philosophical. He had values. He had ideas. He had, and he was an idea guy for George Washington. He had this breadth of experience that Washington didn't have. Washington had spent his entire life in Virginia on a plantation. He did not understand the bigger international world. Alexander Hamilton knew something about that, and he had an idea about strategies and things that he could do. So Washington was depending on him philosophically. Second thing is Hamilton wrote beautifully, and Washington could barely write. He was not a well-educated man, and so he was depending on him for writing his little missives and instructions. And then the third thing was he was extremely organized. And Washington was not particularly organized. And so he could sort of keep everything straight and was good at administration. So Washington becomes super fond of Alexander Hamilton. Washington's wife, Martha, becomes extremely fond of this kid, Alexander Hamilton, handsome young guy. And he becomes almost like a son. Washington. And for the rest of their lives, at this point, Washington is 45, Hamilton's about 20, but for the rest of their lives until Washington dies, Alexander Hamilton is almost like a son to George Washington. Okay, Martha gets in the scene here, and she starts introducing Alexander Hamilton to her friends. Martha and George Washington were the elite and the wealthy. And so she introduces little Alexander to Eliza Schuyler, her father. That's an old Dutch family. And the Schuylers were very wealthy, and they were New Yorkers. And the father was a general in the Continental Army. Not commander-in-chief, but right in the very top echelon. And so Alexander Hamilton marries Eliza Schuyler. So now he's married into one of the sort of top families in this rebellious United States. Now, wow, what a change from this poor, penniless orphan kid in the Caribbean to 10 years later, he's aide-de-camp to the general. He's married one of the other general's daughters. And then he was in the thick of the Revolutionary War all the way through. And he was right by Washington's side. And that was a long war. You know, they declared in 1776, and I think the war didn't actually end until 10, 12 years later. And the only way they won was they just outlasted the British. They never were stronger than the British. They just outlasted them. And then finally, the Brits leave in defeat. But then they have to figure out, okay, how do we govern? And really, it's 13 different colonies that have kind of loosely joined together. But it was 13 different armies. The Continental Army was made up of an army from each of the colonies. And so George Washington was trying to keep together this coalition, but they were all funded by their individual states. And so it was really disorganized. But they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we set up a new government? And that's when they start to write the Constitution. And they call a Constitutional Congress, and they're looking for representatives from all of the 13 colonies to come together and to try to figure out how to run the government. And so Alexander Hamilton was elected as one of the representatives from New York to the Constitutional Congress. And it is in Philadelphia again. And he was only 32 years old. So New York and Virginia were the big dogs. They were the big states. They had the most power. And he lived in New York. So he was a representative from New York. There were only two representatives from New York. He was one of those two. He was only 32 years old. So he goes to the Constitutional Congress, where they're writing the Constitution, and he had really strong ideas. And you know something? He got just cut down in the Constitutional Congress. He had these big ideas, and they did not fly. He was in the minority there, and over his ideas got shot down. So he was not particularly successful there, but he planted a lot of very good ideas. And then at the end of that, they came up with a constitution, but it had to be adopted by all 13 states. Each of them had their own legislature, and they each had to adopt this constitution or it wouldn't be valid. And so they went on a campaign to try to sell this to all those 13 states. And he and James Madison were the two primary salesmen for the Constitution. So he was from New York, which was the most critical vote. And James Madison was from Virginia, which was the second most critical vote. Those were the two big population centers. And so they got their states, New York and Virginia, on board. But then they had to try to sell it to the rest of the country. And they did that by writing the Federalist Papers. And the Federalist Papers were these pamphlets that essentially outlined why this was the right way to go forward in this new country. And they were all written by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, half by Madison, half by Hamilton. And they became the big advocates going out there and selling this. And it was adopted by all 13 states. And then George Washington was selected to be president of this new organization. And George Washington appointed Alexander Hamilton to be Secretary of Treasury, a very key position in this new country, and that was, of course, Alexander Hamilton was his boy, and he depended on him very heavily, so putting him in that key position, not surprising at all. Now, this is really where there are many people who think that Alexander Hamilton is, in some ways, the father of our country. It was his ideas that ended up being so important in the formulating of what the United States was to become. Partly because of the influence he had over Washington over and over again. If there was a critical issue and there was a dispute, it was Washington going to Hamilton and Hamilton writing him a white paper and convincing him that that was the right way to go. So right behind the power of Washington was the brain power of Alexander Hamilton. So he's on the $10 bill right there. And when you think about it, that's extremely weird. I mean, we have all presidents on our bills. Well, Franklin. But basically, it's like Lincoln, and it's Washington, and it's Thomas Jefferson, and Ulysses Grant, and these presidents. Why in the hell do we have Alexander Hamilton? We have Alexander Hamilton because he was such a fundamental part of formulating, especially the economic side of America. In some ways, he was the inventor of capitalism. He really got it was the notion of entrepreneurship, with capital as a means of giving people opportunity and people being able to take advantage of that and get economic wealth by their own hard work. So, he's on the money for a really good reason. He had an enormous impact. So let's think for a minute about some of the things he did. One of the earliest things he did was that he got all of the states to agree to pool their debt. So funding all those armies for the Revolutionary War, most of the states had to go in debt to do that. So they borrowed money to support their army. So all of them had different debts, and they had different amounts of debt. Some of them were more affluent, and they weren't in terrible shape. Some of them had just mortgaged themselves to the hilt, and they were basically bankrupt. So you've got the state who managed pretty well, and the state who just made a big mistake and took on too much debt. And, you know, one doesn't want to cover for the other, and so there's all these disputes between all the states. And Alexander Hamilton said, nope, we got to pool all the debt. The federal government needs to take control of all the debt and take the responsibility for paying it all off, and we ought to do this all together. Now, that was a huge problem for many of the founding fathers, because they saw this as a coalition of states. They were states' rights. They were all about each state having its own power. But if you pooled the debts, the dollars are in the federal government. The federal government is the one who's running the show economically if they pool the debts. So they pooled the debts, and then he figured out that the way we're going to pay off that debt is we're going to have duties or taxes on things that come in on trade, on imports and exports. So we're going to have a whole system of taxation of import and export. That actually doesn't hurt the individual so much. That taxation is going to merchants, and so that was not terribly controversial. But then he also had the idea of excise tax, which would be on things like whiskey. And that started the whiskey revolution in the early days of the country, because he wanted to tax people who made whiskey and sold whiskey, that they would have to pay tax. And that was not a popular thing. So excise tax and duties, that was going to raise money for the government that would then pay off this collective debt that the all of the individual states had pooled together. He made a deal to do all that, and it involved, the capital was in New York at that time. He was from New York. He traded the capital being in New York for the capital moving down to Washington, which was basically in Virginia. So the Virginia guys agreed because they got the capital, and then if New York and Virginia were in agreement, then they got everybody else to follow suit. So it was a big negotiation. This guy was in the center of all that, and he basically made the federal government much stronger and the state governments much weaker. That was Alexander Hamilton, who figured that relationship out. Another thing was he made the presidency far stronger than probably is clear in the Constitution, because he felt like this Congress was out of control and could make decisions. And here was Washington, the smart guy, and, you know, so he was essential in getting a lot more power for the president of the three branches of government. This guy was fundamentally involved in these really big decisions about states' rights versus federal rights, about the three branches of government, where the power lied. He was the man on a lot of those decisions. Okay, so where did all this come from? And I want us to think about, what are Alexander Hamilton's values? What's driving these decisions? The first thing, big, big overriding value, is he believed in stability through government. He had seen in the chaos of the Caribbean, he had seen if you don't have some kind of centralized power, things just go to hell. You have to have a very strong centralized government, and that creates stability, and then from that you can have a good society. He was a very strong abolitionist. He hated slavery. In that Constitutional Congress, he wanted slavery abolished in the Constitution, and he fought hard for that. And of course, the Southern states, no way they were going to accept that, and he got totally shot down. But if he had gotten his way when they wrote the Constitution, we would not have had the Civil War 80 years later. And it would not have been a bleeding sore that the country was trying to deal with for that 80 years. He had the foresight to see this is incompatible with all men are created equal. This is not compatible with the kind of government, the kind of country we're setting up. He saw that, and he was an avid abolitionist. A third thing is he believed in upward mobility. This was his story. He came from nowhere, and he was able to make something of himself. He thought every American ought to have that possibility. This is the great thing about this new country is we're going to have a place where people can have upward mobility. And at that point, no country had that. That it was always the wealthy families passed on their wealth to their heirs. And if you were poor, you were poor for the rest of your life. There was no such thing as upward mobility. So he wanted to make a whole country that was based on upward mobility. He also believed in meritocracy, that if people work hard, if they accomplish something, if they're productive, they need to be rewarded for it. There needs to be economic reward in hard work and in being productive. And he wanted to set an economic system where it was a meritocracy. You got wealth based on your contribution to the society. And the fifth thing was he totally believed in the benefits of a mercantile economy. He'd grown up in this kind of mercantile world, and he could see how that's the future. The future is all about mercantile economy. So the agricultural age was just ending, and this was a guy who saw the future. He had a vision for the mercantile age, where it's all going to be about trade, and it's all going to be about commerce. And we need to leave agricultural age behind. And he believed there were huge benefits in that mercantile economy. So he had enormous ambitions for the United States. He wanted the U.S. to be a country that rivaled its European powers. And, you know, we take that for granted now, but that was a revolutionary idea that the U.S. might be as strong as France or Spain or Great Britain. That was unthinkable, but that was his goal. And the way he thought that would happen was that the United States would be financially interdependent with Europe. He thought that we could be strong in agriculture, we could be strong in industry, production of goods, and we could be strong in trade. And because we had the natural resources, we could kind of win in agriculture and in production. And then if we were really good merchants and we had the right trade relationships, we could make out like bandits with this interdependency with Europe. Whereas there were plenty of people who were saying, okay, we beat the Brits in the war, now we don't have anything to do with Europe anymore. And he was quite the opposite. No, we need to immediately go back and trade with the Brits. Of course we should, because we can make money off those guys. And our relationship with the French had helped fund the Revolutionary War. We need to be interdependent economically with France. We need to be a part of this world community. So he also thought that the availability of capital was super important to encourage entrepreneurship. So we needed some kind of financial mechanism where if you had a good idea, you could borrow some money and you could set up what you needed to, and then you could make it productive and then pay the money back, and you could, as an entrepreneur, that would get you started. But there needed to be that engine of capital that made things run. That basically is the notion of capitalism. Okay, so how do I do this? I've got this vision. All right, he's got these values that came from who he was, his childhood, what he had experienced as a kid. He has this vision of what America's going to be. Now, how does he design them? So one thing is he knew that we had to have a strong federal government that's dominant over the state government. You can have 13 radically different sets of rules, and even people thought there were going to be 13 currencies. Everybody was going to have their own money system. No way! That's going to happen. We've got to have a strong centralized government. So number one, he had federal government assuming the debt of the states. That was really critical. The second design element was to establish a federal treasury that could manage the debt through customs revenue, as I mentioned, and through excise taxes. So they had a source of income. And then the third design element was there would be a strong central bank. And that bank would loan money, and that would give capital to anyone who wanted to start these kind of entrepreneurial things. But the bank was super essential. The fourth is that there would be a diversified market economy. We would not be all in agriculture or all in industry, but we'd have a lot of different things, and different parts of the country had different capabilities. Some had more natural resources, some had more human capital. We need to have a diverse market economy, and we had to have a stable currency. He started the mint, and he's the one, he actually had was very involved in designing the money. And he also set up the Coast Guard to patrol the shores to make sure that you could collect all those duties. He knew how people would try to get around him. There'd be smugglers. He'd seen that. So the Coast Guard was there to make sure that all those taxes got collected and goods didn't enter the country without paying taxes. He set up all these lighthouses. And he set up a whole infrastructure of federal government and had hundreds and hundreds of employees. He was the biggest part of federal government, setting up all this taxing and banking and policing and all of that to really make this stable new economy. Okay, so this is very clearly different from Thomas Jefferson. We'll look at him on Thursday, but this guy believes in cities and commerce and centralized government, and he's pursuing it vigorously. Okay, we've got a few minutes here where I want to have a little conversation with you about this. All right. This is an interesting story. I think these case studies are super good for letting you see how does somebody become a creative problem solver? How does this work? And this values, vision, design, super important in that. But the real thing here is this is a practical course. You're trying to figure out how do I learn to solve problems creatively? How do I use values, vision, and design? So I want us to talk a little bit here about how do you acquire values? Where do your values come from? And what values do you have that might drive vision or design? And I'm thinking in particular about your project this semester. What kind of values are you going to bring to that project? And how is it going to help you formulate a vision and a design? So if we go back to Dijon, the student who from last year who came in and talked earlier in the semester, he had these anger management issues. Well, What really was driving, number one, his choice of what problem to solve, and then also what was driving how he solved that problem. And I will tell you that one of the really driving things there were Dijon's values. This is a guy who believes in civility and niceness. He is a super, super nice guy. He wants to treat people really respectfully and really well, and he wants to be treated respectfully and really well. And he believes that to his core. This is one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my life. I really respect him for that. That is values. What's important in the world? You know, one huge important thing is being a nice person, treating other people respectfully and nice. And yet he's got these anger issues, where sometimes, just out of nowhere, bam, I get really angry and I say something or I do something that hurts. someone else. His values said that is unacceptable. And that helped lead him to why he chose that problem, because it's not okay to get angry and spout off at someone. And then that helped him also figure out, how do I solve this problem? How do I envision those behaviors that I want to have? How do I envision what I would do when I get angry? And then how do I go about helping myself do that? So it was values that were driving his project. It was a personal project, but it was values still that were driving that. As you're focusing in on what your problem is, how do you identify values that will help you solve that problem, help you understand that problem better? And then that brings you back to, well, where do my values come from? Every time when we read Twitter card questions, it's very clear that you're all over the map. Last time the Twitter card question was, do we do this top down or do we do this bottom up? And, you're all over the place. It was probably 50-50. They're clearly very different values in this class. Where did those values come from? Why does one person think it's absolutely got to be bottom up? Otherwise, you're infringing on my freedom. And someone else says, no, no, it's actually going to be top down, because you need that kind of authority and framework for people to work with you. Those are values. When we started talking about political values here, and I said, okay, how many of you believe in a woman's right to choose whether she has an abortion or not, or how many people think that there ought to be a law against abortion? Some of you would have values one way, some of you would have values another way. If we talked about what should the U.S. immigration policy be, how much should we let people from other countries come to the U.S. and contribute to our economy or our culture, or how much should we make sure that that does not happen and that we protect the rights of people already here in the United States? And what are the mechanisms for implementing that immigration strategy? We would have values that drove you all different ways. So I want to know a little bit here, where do your values come from? Where do you think you get your values? Okay, so let me give you a few options. Yeah, okay, what do you think we get?
I think that I get a lot of my values personally from like my parents and my family. Like, sorry, my dad is very open, like just emotionally he's very honest with us, and I feel like that's a value that he sort of imparted onto us, and it's something that I sort of take seriously and find very important. So like a problem that I see and that I sort of was trying to think about for like my project was a fear of people to be open, because not everyone has that kind of like experience growing up, and how that can relate to like people's like mental health and like well-being. And so I was sort of trying to take that value and use it to determine the problem.
Excellent. That's a really good example of that. And probably if you choose that for your project, taking that value first and foremost, and always realizing that's the driver here. That is the standard by which I make judgment. That's the definition of a value. And that begins to be the standard by which you make judgments going forward. So what about somebody else? Where do we get our values?
From different situations you go through that, like, it's mostly like the most challenging, you know, times where you like learn to value some things more than others. So that's where I get my values.
So life experiences, and that certainly was true for Alexander Hamilton. The life experiences he went through shaped his values enormously. So definitely, maybe your parents, your background that way, maybe your experiences, the things you've gone through. What else?
I think also looking at other people and seeing how they like act or interact with others, you decide maybe you want to be like that, maybe you don't, you think that's important. So I think that's also where you develop your values.
Excellent. So that's role models or mentors or other people that influence your values? Yeah.
I think one of the largest influences of values for me, especially, is educational institutions, especially going through high school. Something that was instilled in us was like a value towards service and giving back to this community. And that's something that we saw because of the different service projects that we were, that were mandatory for graduation, or like the amount of hours was like 100 for a senior year in order to just even have an extra grade or something like that. There's a lot of different types of systems that sort of guide our thinking and our values, and I think education is one of them.
Excellent. Those are four really good sources of values. I want you to think, what are the things that influence my values? What are my values in relation to this question? I do want to just talk about one other thing that I think is super poignant in Alexander Hamilton, and that is another key term of confidence. I want to make the point here that this kid was very, very not confident at the beginning. So when Hugh Knox wanted his letter published in the newspaper, he did not think he was good enough. He was embarrassed. He was not confident about putting himself out there. How did he then, 10 years later, get to be this extremely confident person who could stand up in the Constitutional Congress and fight for abolition of slavery, or someone who could work with George Washington to set up a whole federal banking system? How do you go from no confidence to confidence? And there is a little key term here that, again, I'll probably use all semester, but incremental small successes. Where he got his confidence was from incremental small successes. So his being able to be a clerk in a little half-assed mercantile operation in the Caribbean, the fact that he could master that writing and accounting, that was an incremental small success. Then the fact that he could get his poetry published in the newspaper, that was an incremental small success. Then when he was kind of forced to put his essay about the hurricane in the newspaper and people responded to it, it was an incremental small success. Then when people sponsored him to go to the United States, it was an incremental small success. And it was just small things over and over again that built his confidence. And it is really impressive how he went from a kid with zero confidence. And for good reason, he had no accomplishment. He had zero confidence. And then 10 years later, he's this very confident person. So that's just an aside I want us to note on Alexander Hamilton. Okay.